From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. India is the world's largest democracy with a population of more than 1.2 billion people. It's also an incredibly diverse place where people speak more than 100 different languages. It's home to both world-beating technology companies as well as tens of millions of people who live in traditional farming communities much as their ancestors did hundreds of years ago. The media environment in India reflects its diversity. There are 90,000 different print publications and more than 700 TV stations, and there is vibrant debate and criticism of government policies. But on a number of fronts, the freedom of expression and freedom of the press in India is facing threats. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Hindu Nationalist Party have accused three television companies of violating broadcasting regulations for their reporting on a terrorism case. Books deemed offensive to Hinduism have been pulled from bookshelves and authors threatened. Journalists routinely face threats, particularly in the countryside. At least six have been killed this year, according to the International Federation of Journalists. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look inside India's ongoing struggle with press freedom and how things look for the future. We've got a packed show today. We're going to start with Shubhranshu Chowdhury from the city of Raipur in central India. He's a Knight International Journalism Fellow working to train citizen journalists in rural India. Before that, he was a BBC South Asia producer for more than 10 years. Mr. Chowdhury, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you.
Tell us just a little bit about some of the communities that you work in. How do people live and how do they get their information about the outside world?
It was very interesting. You talked about hundreds of television stations, thousands of newspapers. You didn't mention radio. You said India is the world's biggest democracy. And I'm sure you would be surprised to know that we have only one radio station which can do news in this huge country where a huge majority can get information only through radio because, you know, we have, as you very rightly said, the smartest people in Mumbai, in Bangalore, in Delhi, but in the middle of the country where I am sitting, we have more than 100 million people who are from indigenous communities and they have no voice. They speak hundreds of languages, as you very rightly said. There are no communication platforms in those languages. So things have deteriorated in recent past or in the days we are
Well, talking. Let me stop you there because I did want to ask. Now, you mentioned that in the center of the country, there are millions of people, many of whom aren't literate or illiterate. And so radio is sort of their main source of information, particularly state radio, which is the only authorized news broadcaster. So what effect does that have on sort of democracy and how and governance in these areas?
Biggest democracy, but it is democracy for rich. The only way to listen to anything, that they can't read and write, they don't have electricity even to have television, and that don't broadcast in their languages. And whatever we have in the name of free journalism is completely funded by either corporates or the government. In the state I'm sitting, every newspaper and television station gets 70% or more funding from the government. And even in cities of Mumbai and liberated areas of Bangalore and Delhi, 99% of contribution to run this free press comes from a very small number of people, which we call advertisement. So this whole idea of independent journalism is a big suspect.
Well, tell us just a little bit about this project that you're working on in rural India and that you've been working on for a number of years. What are the goals of that?
India is still a rural country. Still around 70% people live in rural India. But if you look at mainstream media, they do not give even 2% space to this huge number of people. So what we are trying to do is to put things upside down. What we have so far is only a top-down, one-way, city-centric media. Can we have democratic media where people tell their own stories? We have mobile phone now reaching almost every villages in India. If we connect mobile phone with internet and radio, we can create a democratic model of communication like we have in politics. We just changed the government 2 days back where Mr. Modi had a humiliating defeat. But the same thing we need to do in journalism. We need democratization of media, which is possible by linking these three technologies. But as I said before, unfortunately, we are world's biggest democracy, but we do not have radio.
So in other words, what's different about what you're doing is you're trying to go around this regulation that only allows state radio to broadcast over the radio airwaves and effectively have radio via the internet by different people, or different people who wouldn't have voices otherwise in rural India.
Yes, in our model, people use their phone to record their messages. We cross-check, verify, or what you call journalism. We do it on internet, and it goes back to them through their mobile phone only, which we should be ideally putting out on radio, because mobile phone is expensive. To listening on mobile phone is very expensive. So it does not work as an economic model. But yes, that's what we would like to do, that can media be democratic? Can every voice has same respect as we have in political democracy?
Well, what are some of the difficulties that you've encountered in doing this project that some of the people who are doing this type of mobile phone-based citizen journalism have encountered?
So the first problem is legal, as I said, that to make this idea or a model a sustainable, replicable model, we need shortwave and medium wave radio. And we do not have even a provision to apply for a shortwave or medium wave radio here. We face different kind of problems, like where we are in the middle of a civil war between communist, Maoist guerrillas and state or police. The guerrillas also do not like us, because what is happening when people's voices are coming out, and we do have some good officers who are proactive and solves those problems, they do not like that, it looks. So we face problems from both sides. State don't like, because they have managed the mainstream, the so-called mainstream media, quite well. And when the stories come out of human rights violation, of corruption, which are not coming out because the journalist who is at the bottom gets all his salary or income as a cut of that advertisement he or she needs to collect. So they don't like when stories of corruption and human rights violation come out by citizen journalists using their mobile phone. And similarly, the people, those who are inside the forest, they also don't like when problems get solved, because if problems get solved, who will go to them? So we face problems from all sides.
Shubhanshu Chowdhury, thanks so much for joining us on the program. This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at threats to free expression and the press in India. We're going to pull in three other guests now for a broader look at this issue. Joining us from New York, Bob Dietz. He's the coordinator of the Committee to Protect Journalists Asia program. From Delhi, Karuna Nundi, an Indian Supreme Court lawyer and civil liberties advocate. And from Mumbai, Rishi Majumdar. He's a freelance journalist and the associate partner of a new media company called Oijo. He's also written for numerous different media outlets, including Yahoo, the newspapers Dawn and The Hindu. 2, 1. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Rishi Majumdar, we did hear about some of the difficulties faced by journalists in these rural areas of India. What has your experience been? Do you see some of the same divide between how the media operates in rural areas and villages and how it operates in sort of India's big booming cities?
There's definitely a huge divide between how the media operates in the rural areas and in the metropolises. There's also a divide between how the media operates in the metropolises and the smaller towns and the tier two cities, so to speak. In fact, if you look at the killings of journalists this year, you'll find six, you mentioned six cases that have been noticed by CPJ. And you'll see that most of the cases have been of journalists who have been killed in either small towns or rural Indias. So that should be telling.
Well, Karuna Nundi, I wanted to ask you about this incident that we mentioned earlier in which the government accused these three Indian television stations of violating broadcasting regulations for their reporting on a terrorist case. I think the offenses were along the lines of disrespecting the judiciary, disrespecting the office of the president. Tell us just a little bit about that case.
So that case was interesting. I mean, I think the government has, by various means, been sort of pulling out regulations and using existing law in particular ways to limit speech. So this example was one where, you know, there was somebody who was convicted of a terrorist offense called Yakub Memon. There was a death sentence that was passed against him, and his lawyer spoke on a few TV channels around the time.
So I'm sorry, so Yakub Memon, he had been convicted of involvement in these 1993 bombings in Mumbai, is that correct?
That's exactly right. And his lawyer made some comments about a Supreme Court judgment, and he said that, of course, we are bound by the judgment, and the Supreme Court decided this in their wisdom. Now, cable television rules were sort of extracted, you know, used, taken out of nowhere, really, and sent to these three TV channels. And, you know, I was asked for advice in one of the cases. And look, it's clear. Our contempt of court law is not great, but it's up to the judiciary, really, essentially. And it's very clear, and the cable television rules sort of seek to sort of shoot off the shoulders of the judiciary. And the judiciary is perfectly capable of taking care of itself.
So in other words, what occurred then is that there was the stations had aired criticism of this, of the judicial rulings in the case after this man was executed then, is that correct?
Exactly, and we have an explicit law. The law of defamation actually very explicitly says that when there is a decided case and where there's a decided decision, that, you know, fair critique of it is explicitly allowed. So this is actually a great example of odd, unconstitutional powers being used to suppress speech.
Well, Bob Dietz of the Committee to Protect Journalists, give us just an overview of what your research shows. We have been talking about this case involving the Indian television channels. How does this fit into sort of the bigger context in India with regards to press freedom, freedom of expression over the past year or two?
I think this is typical, not just of India, really, but of many countries around India and many countries around the world, frankly. In terms of journalists being killed, as Rishi had mentioned, more than 90% of all the journalists killed in the world are local journalists covering local stories, and that's not unique to India.
So these are like people saying like the local district officer is corrupt or
exactly.
This company is doing
taking
something
on
illegal.
Local strongman taking on a corruption issue, taking on environmental issues, a very dangerous area, logging or water abuse or mining, and it's really typical of much of the world. In terms of the government using legal methods to kind of suppress free speech, again, not unique to India, but each country goes about it in their own way. In China, say, you see the use of state security laws and threatening state security, social stability, and these very wide, broad issues that are really hard to defend against in court. In India, we do see a more coned down, more specific attempt to use the law as it stands, rather than these wide, broad, sweeping penalties to confront people who are really, you know, raising issues, raising legitimate issues that make the government uncomfortable. I'll leave it to this is a fascinating discussion, by the way. I'll leave it to the people in India to tell us whether or not this has really increased under the Modi government. Our feeling here is that it's always been a tendency within India, that there is a strong conservative resistance to speech. Sometimes it seems to be growing out of the concern that there'll be social disruption, that there'll be political violence or ethnic violence if people speak too freely and sort of let their speech broaden out into hate speech. But frankly, we see India as really struggling with these issues, and I think as Karuna said, they're not doing a very good job of it. I think they're really resistant to allowing this broader speech.
Well, Rishi Majumdar, let me toss that to you then. I want to ask you to touch on sort of the broader climate for freedom of expression in India, because we have seen successful campaigns against books and against authors in India over the past couple of years, whose writings have been seen as disrespectful to Hinduism. Of course, Prime Minister Modi's government is a Hindu nationalist government.
Yes, you have seen campaigns against books and authors, but I think that what you're seeing in India for the first time, this is a very interesting trend, is a campaign by authors and a movement in a way by authors. And they have found a very imaginative and novel way of protesting in a way. They're protesting by returning their awards. And according to me, I think one of the problems with free speech in India is one of the issues is that how do you make it a very relevant, a wider issue? How do you take the issue of free speech in a country which is suffering from so many other issues and make it something that is relevant to the common man, so to say? And it is relevant to the common man, because in a democracy it is just as relevant. Food, clothing, shelter, all these things rely on what you can learn about what your government does and how it affects you. And one thing the writers' protests has done is, if the writers were protesting by, let us say, staging a protest march merely, or by writing about this, as I think one columnist had suggested that the writers should just stick to writing, and if they had done this, then this protest wouldn't have really caught on. But now, finally, the writers have a voice. It's being covered not just in the media, but a lot of people across the country are talking about it. And that's because the writers have found a novel way of protesting.
So in other words, you're saying that what had been sort of maybe viewed as a problem of the elite or an English-speaking elite in the cities, there's some broader awareness of it right now then. Is that fair to say?
That's right.
Well, let me turn that to you, Karuna Nundi. One of your clients in the Indian Supreme Court is this well-known global environmental group, Greenpeace. They've been sued for defamation in India. Tell us about that case. That does strike me as an interesting one.
Well, we still have criminal defamation as a provision, you know, which is very problematic. A lot of countries have gotten rid of it.
So in other words, you face criminal charges, potential jail time for defaming someone. In many countries, that's a civil case where you might have to pay some money for defaming someone. Is that
precisely
correct?
So if you reduce somebody if you sort of damage somebody's reputation, not only could they take you to court for massive damages, and we are developing responses to these strategic lawsuits against public participation, but also that you could go to jail for it. And the problem is that you can only bring truth as a defense after the trial started. And because our courts are quite slow, because we don't have enough judges per million, essentially, like in any other criminal case, the process is the punishment, right? So for Greenpeace, we are currently in the Supreme Court asking for the provision to be struck down as unconstitutional.
And Greenpeace was sued by a mining company, is that correct, for their activism related to environmental damage?
SR, the mining company, brought a criminal case against a Greenpeace campaigner called Priya Pillai and alleged essentially all sorts of things that she didn't say, which makes our case easier. But of course, the problem is that once she goes through the process, that even to bring those facts before the court just takes a certain amount of time. She has to get legal representation, and she has a sort of sword of Damocles of imprisonment hanging over her head. So this illustrates the problem quite well, right? Because there are various layers to lay out the problem for you. There's the existence of problematic laws. Recently, we sort of reordered online free speech to bring it closer to constitutional free speech, and the notorious Section 66A, which criminalized anything that any speech with an electronic interface that is annoying or inconvenient, was struck down as unconstitutional by our Supreme Court. But we still have a number of laws, many of which have been inherited by the British colonial government, that still exist and that are still used. The second problem is that we don't have enough judges per million. We have about 14.5, and you know what's recommended is about 50 per million. And we also don't have enough police. So two things result from that. One is that when a writer or a journalist is being threatened, we don't have adequate witness protection programs or police protection to make sure that that doesn't happen, which gives non-state actors also a lot of power then. And the way courts sometimes then react is to limit the speech sometimes, and at the first instance, let me make clear, at the magistrate's level or, you know, less frequently at the sessions judge level, to limit the speech rather than deal with the mob, because the mobs are too large. When these cases go up to the Supreme Court, our Supreme Court has quite a strong record in protecting free speech. But sort of these are our various problems. And when we speak of the killing of journalists, that is a problem of non-state actors and sometimes tacit support of those non-state actors by some state actors.
Well, let me turn this to Bob Dietz of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Karuna and Nundi have been talking about non-state actors, this problem of impunity, and that's something that your organization has done a lot of research on in India. Tell us about the situation here. We have heard about six journalists being killed this year. Your group has done a lot of research over the last 10 years as to how many of these sort of local strongmen or non-state actors, if you will, actually end up, you know, facing penalties for killing journalists.
No, I think Karuna got it right. There's a high degree of impunity for the killers of journalists in India. But frankly, there's a high degree of impunity for people who kill street fruit vendors, or who kill civilians, or who kill other people, that the courts are not up to the task. Just because of the numbers I think she cited were pretty telling. Also, I think there's a lack of political will very often on the part of the government to aggressively attack the cases in which journalists are killed. And you're right again by and large the journalists being killed are in rural areas, but not always. But either rural or urban, the court system doesn't seem to be up to the task. I think the bigger. By the way, our numbers aren't as large as a six killed this year. We only have one. Case confirmed, and two cases in which we're still investigating.
So that figure of six, it comes from the International Federation of Journalists.
That's right,
so not
CPJ. Not to worry about that so much. There's also there's usually a very wide discrepancy of numbers amongst all the different groups keeping tally. Our numbers tend to be the most conservative, frankly. I think what you're seeing in India, just to broaden this discussion a bit, is a society emerging, growing rapidly, and it's trying to come to grips with the issues of communications, modern communications methods, this democratization of communication and broadcast using all these different digital platforms rather than traditional radio. And I think the government is struggling to sort out how to control this, and whether or not it's going to be able to allow this much freer, broader flow of information. Again, what Karuna said, and Karuna, I find your response is fascinating. What Karuna said about once you finally get these cases up to the Supreme Court level, there's a a generally honest attempt to resolve these things according to the Constitution. It's at the lower level where these things have to wend their way through court and make their way up there, in which the actual punishment and the deterrence occurs. This is not unique to India, but I think it's a problem that many other countries are dealing with, and it's something that's going to have to be resolved if India is really going to move ahead and become a modern industrialized nation.
Well, Rishi Majumdar, let me turn that to you then. You know, Bob Dietz is saying that this is part of grappling with the rapid evolution of modern communication technologies. But again, if you could touch on some of these issues related to religion. I mean, we have seen that journalists have been arrested for things like writing about the nutritional benefits of beef, which is, of course, taboo for Hindus to consume. And there is a sense that part of what's going on is that there is some religious tension about what is okay to print in the media.
So, I mean, to answer your question, I don't know, English media and the metropolises is concerned, I don't know if there's a lot of religious tension there, because one can write what one wants to write, and the media there does take on the government very often. But I think that the larger question is the sort of attitude that the government has had with response to various things. So whether it is a culture minister reacting to the incident at Dadri and saying that it is an unfortunate accident. The incident at Dadri is well known, where a man was murdered because he was suspected of having beef in his house. Or whether it is the same culture minister reacting to the writers' protest saying, well, if we'll let the writers stop writing and then we will see. And that reveals a very problematic attitude, because you have to realize that here is a government and here are a lot of various elements who are being called fringe elements, but these fringe elements take their cues from what the government says. So if the government ministers and the members of parliament and the members of the party send out signals, these act as signals saying it's all right. You've had two rationalists murdered this year. You've had another rationalist, Narendra Dabholkar, murdered in 2013, and despite it being over 2 years since its murder, we are still to conclusively determine who his assassins were. So in such a situation, when the government does send out, it is the responsibility of the government and the prime ministers to speak very clearly and send out very clear signals. So even fringe elements feel that it is not okay for them to go ahead and indulge in any sort of violence or threatening. So that would be my response, yes.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Shubhranshu Chaudhary, Bob Dietz, Karuna Nundi, and Rishi Majumdar for coming on the program. Global Journalist Executive Producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Javila Rushkaskate, Zhu Heng, Elenia Kaya, and Arjun Pen. Our studio director is Travis McMillan from RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.